This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Our guests, Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger, are the co-founders of the New Jersey rock band Fountains of Wayne. In a review of their new album, Welcome Interstate Managers, Tom Keelty of the Boston Globe called the band one of rock's most literate acts. Let's hear a song from the new album. This is Hackensack.
I used to know you when we were young. You were in all my dreams. We sat together in period one, Fridays at 8:15. Now I see your face in the strangest places, movies and magazines. I saw you talking to Christopher Walken on my TV screen. But I will wait for you as long as I need to. And if you ever get back to Hackensack, I'll be here for you.
Adam Schlesinger received an Academy Award nomination for writing the title song for Tom Hanks' movie That Thing You Do. Terry spoke to Schlesinger and Chris Collingwood in 1999 after the release of their second album, Utopia Parkway. They talked about the roots of Fountains of Wayne.
We played in a series of bands together before we even started Fountains of Wayne. I mean, we've been playing together in one form or another since we were 18. And the stuff that we did originally was more kind of, I don't know how to describe it. I mean, less rock and more pop maybe, you know. And I think that's where this record has gone, which so in a weird way it feels like kind of back to our roots. I mean, when we made our first album, we went into a studio with a Marshall amplifier and just made a lot of noise, and we had never really recorded anything like that before. And so to us, you know, it was like this big rock extravaganza. And although it probably doesn't sound like that to your average teenager, it probably sounds like a wimpy pop band. But on this record, we wanted to have you know, different kinds of textures on the record, some subtler stuff, some slightly more introspective stuff mixed in with the kind of jokey, fun, loud stuff.
Well, don't sell that first album short. I really like it. And
oh, I don't mean it that way. I mean, the first album was just, it was written in about a week, it was recorded in about another week, and it was just this kind of blast of energy, and I think it's great. I think it's a, you know, it's the perfect way to approach a first record, just have a good time and, you know, create this kind of blueprint for yourself. But we wanted to try to expand on that a little bit and not just do the same thing again.
When that record came out, when your first record came out, rock critic Robert Christgau said that that he thinks you sing the kind of words every shy guy who didn't get the girl thinks of. And I think a good illustration of that point is the song Leave the Biker, which is a really catchy song. Why don't we play that? This is all Leave right. the Biker from the first Fountains of Wayne CD.
Seems the further from town I go, the more I hate this place. He's got leather and big tattoos, scars all over his face. And I wonder if he ever has cried, 'cause he couldn't get a date for the prom. He's got his arm around every man's dream, and crumbs in his beard from the seafood special. Oh, can't you see my world is falling apart? Leave the biker, break his heart. Baby, please, leave the biker, break his heart. Now his friend leans over and says, looks like we got us a fag. I wonder if that guy's read one word that wasn't in a porno mag. And I wonder if he ever has cried, 'cause his kid got run over and died. He's got his arm around every man's dream, crumbs in his beard from the seafood special. Oh, can't you see my world is falling apart? Baby, please, leave the biker, break his heart. Baby, please, leave the biker, break his heart.
That's from the first Fountains of Wayne CD. Do you think Robert Crisco was onto something? Do you think of yourselves as former Shy Guys who didn't get the girl?
I think there's a lot made out of that, actually. And it's funny because...
Too much, you mean?
Well, I think that if people are really eager to call you geek rock or whatever, it sort of lumps you into this convenient category, which ignores the subtler aspects of some of the songwriting, which...
Not that that's the most subtle song that we've ever put out.
Right. And you know, I mean, to some degree, it might have been a mistake to put that song on the record, because I'd hate to sort of go down in history as this joke songwriter. And
oh, but it's catchy. I think it's a good song.
No, it is, and I mean, I think the thing is that, you know, obviously that song's supposed to be fun, and a lot of them are, but at the same time, you know, people, especially in America, I think more so even than in Europe, assume that any voice that you have in a song is you confessing, you know, your inner thoughts, and the idea of writing from like the perspective of a character or something is a little bit confusing to people.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times there's songs written that are not literally supposed to be us speaking our minds, and that sometimes gets missed.
Well, there's nice lines in the song, like the line about the guy having crumbs in his beard from the seafood special.
I think the main thing with that whole sort of geeky sort of tag or whatever is that neither of us would be comfortable writing a song that had a really kind of macho, aggressive pose to it. It definitely does come more naturally to us to write from like a weaker perspective, and maybe it's just because it makes the song more sympathetic or something.
Well, there's that line, I wonder if he's ever cried because he couldn't get a date for the prom. And then there's a prom song on your new CD also that I think is kind of mocking that stereotyped emotion you're supposed to have on the prom, like, this is the crowning moment of my life, and after this I'm going to, like, have a receding hairline and, you know,
right,
just work all the time and life will be over. It's like the oldest cliche in the book about how you're supposed to feel on prom night.
Yeah, I actually went to two high school proms. I went to my own, and then I went to the prom at the high school where my girlfriend at the time went out on Long Island, and they were both pretty much identical, these kind of suburban proms. And even though I was only, whatever, 17 at the time, I was already too cynical to enjoy it. So I kind of ruined it for both of us. And she never really forgave me, you know. I think that was the beginning of the end of our relationship.
Did you play a lot of proms?
No, but we actually wanted to do that now. Talking about, you know, trying to get some proms on our tour schedule for this year.
You're kidding, right?
No, not kidding.
Why would you want to do that?
Because we're a really good cover band, although we don't like to admit it, but we always end up playing a lot of covers, and you know, I think it would be fun.
What do you cover?
Anything people yell out. We played a show in Seattle, or Portland, Oregon, I think it was, actually, on our last tour, where we ended up doing one Billy Joel song for every one of our songs. So by the end of the night, I think we had done, you know, 10 or 12 Billy Joel songs, none of which we had ever played before, but...
Actually, the funny thing about that is, like, I found that online about 6 months later. It became this sort of legendary thing, like in some news group that was like,
they had the set list,
huge, big discussion.
Then they did Just a Fantasy, and then they did, you know, Allentown. It was great.
How did you first meet? You've been playing together a long time.
Yeah, we met in college. We were both, I think, about 19 at the time. We've sort of been playing steadily in bands ever since then. We had about 10 different bands throughout since about 1987
or seven, yeah,
to the present. Most of which were incredibly terrible, and they all had really horrible names. And we actually,
such as,
we used to change our name, you know, once a week
because people that saw us once, like if we advertised with the same name, they'd never come back. We were called Woolly Mammoth.
That was about a...
Three people who, when standing side by side, have a wingspan of over 12 feet.
Are you my mother?
Are you my mother?
why did you call the band that?
That's a children's book, actually.
Oh, yeah, Green Light Go is another children's book.
The silly thing is that Fountains of Wayne was just one of these, you know, in the pile of names that we would just kind of rotate, and that ended up being the one that we got stuck with. But I kind of prefer Are You My Mother, actually. Maybe we should switch it.
Well, how did you come up with Fountains of Wayne, and why is that the name that stuck?
Fountains of Wayne is a store in the town called Wayne, New Jersey, which is near where I grew up. And I think it was something that my mother actually suggested at some point. I mean, she works in Clifton.
That was about 10 years ago.
Yeah, while we were probably
You know? While we were tossing around all these bad band names.
And she was always full of, you know, really horrible ideas for, you know, things we should do to help the band out. So she would suggest these terrible names, and we'd say, oh, God, that's a horrible band name. And she would also say things like, you know, why don't you guys play shows where you have two pianos on stage and you can both play piano and that'll be your gimmick? and I just say, you know, I really don't have time to explain why that's a bad idea right now, but at some point I will.
My family was always saying, you know, why don't you go on that David Letterman show? That seems to do those bands a lot of good.
Was she offering to get you on? Yeah.
No, she just, you know, that was her idea for promotion.
I want to play another recording from your first CD, and this is called She's Got a Problem. I think this is also a really good song. Would you say anything about writing it? Which of you wrote this one?
I wrote it, although Chris had the title, and I kind of took the title and wrote a song around it. I mean, one thing that we did early on a lot was to just sit down and kind of throw out possible song titles, and then it was almost a game to see if, you know, who could turn it into an actual song.
Yeah, we actually sat in a bar and wrote them on bar napkins. I don't know if you still have those, but there's.
Yeah, I have
these
a napkin
soggy
with like,
napkins.
You know, with like 50 possible titles, and most of the songs on our first album are on there somewhere. And then there's a bunch of really bad ones that we couldn't even bring ourselves to write. So yeah, I mean, She's Got a Problem. Funnily enough, was a song that I had sort of been working on a little bit, and when Chris suggested that title, I kind of grafted onto this idea that I had. You know, rolling around.
Girl who should never be alone. I know a girl who should never be alone. She's a danger to herself, and I'm worried about her health. She's got a
that She's Got a Problem from Fountains of Wayne's first album. We're listening to Terry's 1999 interview with the band's co-founders, Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger.
When you wanted to expand the band, did you find the people you wanted to play with in an organic way, or did you actually hold auditions and so on?
We actually tried to hold auditions, didn't we?
Oh my God, that was the most ludicrous thing you've ever seen.
You know, we put an ad in the Village Voice or something and just... You know, I think we met every horrible musician in the New York area. And it's just, I can't even begin to tell you how funny those auditions are.
I think there are people who just make a career out of going to rock auditions. And you can probably tell, like, the guys who showed up, you know, it's their fifth one that day. I can't understand why things aren't going right for them.
Well, how did you tell them what you wanted to hear, or would they just come up with like an audition piece and perform it for you?
Well, most of the time they had a copy of a demo or something, and we're kind of like learn this song and just, you know, wing it, whatever. So they'd show up and plug in, and they'd leave, and we'd laugh, and,
and the next guy would come in. Yeah, I mean, as it turned out, you know, that proved futile really quickly, and so Jody, the guitar player, was someone that I knew because he was the leader of a band for a long time called the Bell Tower, and I had actually played bass for his band briefly. And then Brian, we actually met through a friend of ours who knew Brian from his work with the Posies, and we had never met him, but he just came down. We actually auditioned him in Los Angeles, but the audition was really just kind of a free-for-all
getting together and playing Blue Oyster Cult songs.
Yeah, and Steve Miller covers and things. I mean, we, you know, we knew kind of instantly that he was the right guy, and if it's just whether he wanted to do it or not, we just had a good time playing.
Brian's kind of the rock star in the group, actually. Like, everywhere we go in Europe, everybody's like, they know the Posies really well. So
he's the touring veteran. Him. He was kind of showing us the ropes as we went.
Some people who don't even know that it's Brian in the band will show up and recognize his drum kit, and they say, wow. You know, did you guys buy the Posies drum kit? We're like, no.
So what's the best advice he gave you on weathering a tour?
Well, you know, his whole philosophy is whenever you start complaining too much, you got to just remember that it beats flipping eggs. That's his expression. You know, you can be sitting in some, you know, train station in Germany for 8 hours, and he can say, well, it beats flipping eggs.
That's probably not bad advice.
No.
So, sometimes it doesn't beat flipping eggs.
That's right.
It's the actually, one thing he forgot.
Flipping eggs might be kind of fun right about now.
Adam, I have a question for you. You wrote that song, That Thing You Do, for the Tom Hanks movie. And I thought that was a surprisingly good movie that had a really kind of knowing and loving sense of 60s pop. How did you come to write the song? Was there like a national audition being held for the song? Or
not really. I mean, it was just somebody in the music business that I work with at a music publishing company heard about the movie and said that, you know, they were looking for a song that kind of sounded like this era, and asked me if I wanted to take a stab at it. So I did a demo recording of it with two friends, and we just sent it in. And, you know, we did it really quickly because we just kind of assumed it was such a long shot. It wasn't worth spending that much time on. But, you know, they actually listened to it and they actually liked it. So it was a lucky break.
Yeah, and the movie is about a band that's a one-hit wonder. And the only hit that they have is this song, That Thing You Do. And it's a really catchy record. What did you think about when you wrote this song, knowing that it needed to be a period song?
Well, the obvious reference for the time period they were talking about was the Beatles, but they actually had, as part of the instructions for it, had said that, you know, we'd rather have it sound like an American band that's, you know, kind of a cheap imitation of the Beatles, you know, because there were a lot of bands sprouting up then.
The Knickerbockers.
Yeah, that kind of stuff, you know, trying to capitalize on what the Beatles had done. So that's what I was going for.
Okay, well, this is your song, That Thing You Do. Your knowledge of rock and pop goes back a long way, and I'm wondering, what do you remember the first records you each bought?
I think the first full-length LP I was ever allowed to buy was Bat Out of Hell by Meatloaf. My parents obviously had all those Beatles records sitting around and stuff, but I remember, I think I was in sixth grade when Bat Out of Hell came out. It was that record.
You were like,
and,
whoa.
Yeah, that really cool. That motorcycle on the cover was just so excellent.
The first record I ever bought was this exercise record that they made us buy in first grade. It was called Chicken Fat.
We had to listen
to that record
too. Yeah,
it was like push-ups every morning
10 times,
not just now and then, 10 times.
One, two.
And they'd make you exercise to it, and then they'd also make you buy
it would like, give that chicken fight back to the chicken, and don't be chicken again.
I can't believe you're the only person I've ever mentioned this to that knows what the hell I'm talking about.
I want to know what kind of fascist elementary schools you two went to. Chicken fight.
Chicken fat.
Oh, was this really funny? Well,
all the weak students. The strong students will survive.
Kill the weak.
Oh, it was this military-style workout record, yeah. Oh,
that's just horrible.
So you really liked it? This is an influence on your music?
I never said I liked it.
And tell me again why you brought it up.
You asked us the first record we ever bought.
Oh, and they made you buy it.
Oh, yeah, it was forced purchase.
That's right.
I should suggest to our record company that strategy of forcing first graders to buy our album. Because there's a lot of first graders out there, you know, and they've all got lunch money.
That's a good idea.
We could just go rob them instead of making them buy the records.
Yeah, why bring this whole record thing into it?
Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger, co-founders of the band Fountains of Wayne. They spoke with Terry in 1999. They have a new album, Welcome Interstate Managers. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. Let's hear Stacy's Mom.
Thank you.